As the first generation of kids who grew up owning a Nintendo Entertainment System, we, children of the 80s, can chart our lives through the games that we played. There is a man who has done just this, and even wrote a book on it, and in this episode we're going to talk to him about that book entitled A Game in the Life. Welcome to the Thirsty Mage, the digital pub where we sit down to have a pint and a discussion about video games. I'm here with my co-host, who just happens to also be the guest of honor, since he's written an excellent memoir slash tribute to some of the most timeless games of our generation, and that man is Jordan Rudick.
Yeah, hey David, thanks for having me on for this one. It's been quite a ride, a three-year journey here, kind of producing the book, producing A Game in the Life, and I'm excited to kind of get into it with you. And I don't expect this to be just, you know, us talking for, you know, 40, 60 minutes about, you know, how great the book is. But, you know, again, you mentioned like us kind of growing up in the 80s, like so many of these games we grew up with, they're kind of touchstones for us. And so I think it's going to be a lot of kind of memory sharing here. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I was just thinking about it. I finished your book today, which, and I'll start off by saying I greatly enjoyed it.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you.
Nice to, I love the kind of how you've interweaving your life, stories about your life with the different games. So it was, you can kind of see the timeline going on. But yeah, it was just afterwards, I was even thinking about how, like we're around the same age. I'm a little bit older than you, but we're kind of from the same generation of, we were around the 5 to 10 years old when the NES came out, and the NES is kind of, I know Atari was there before and Commodore 64 and stuff, but NES, like Nintendo was kind of the beginning, really, I would say, like the golden age of video games. So to have us of that age when it came out, you know, if you're a little bit older, what, like you're kind of already past, like you're already in the teenage years, like,
yeah.
And if you're younger, then you might have even missed the Nintendo Entertainment System, and your first system was Super Nintendo or later. So we're kind of the first generation of lifelong gamers, I would say, to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, it was really easy for people to get into the NES, I think, because it was kind of ubiquitous. Like everyone either had one in their home or knew someone who did, you know, and you just came across it all over the place. Like for some reason, and I mentioned this in one of the early chapters of the book, like both of my grandparents had NESs. On my dad's side, I never saw them play a game. I don't know why they had it. I guess they had it for like their kids or whatever. But the kids would have maybe been moved out of the house by then. So it was, I don't even know. I need to dig into that a little bit more. Like, why did my paternal grandparents have an NES? I have no idea. My grandma on my mom's side, she played Bomberman. She played NES Bomberman. So, and it was like literally the only game she played. And then my grandfather, he would play like NES golf games. Not even like the generic golf, but like, gosh, what, like Pebble Beach something and Lee Trevino's Fighting Golf, like just these great obscure golf games that no one would know unless you were really into golf, which he was. And I kind of a little bit, you know, very curiously through him or eventually, you know, he would take me out and play golf a bunch of times. But it was just funny that the NES was kind of everywhere. And of course, you know, everybody was talking about it. All of our friends were playing it. You know, we couldn't really escape it, nor did we want to. So yeah, the growing up kind of around the time when the NES was just hitting its stride, I mean, it was a magical time for sure.
Yeah, and it's the same. Like my grandma had an Atari, which I assume was my dad, since because my aunts, like my dad was the only boy and he had four sisters, and but I never saw my dad pick up a video game in his life, so yeah, I don't know why the Atari was there.
Yeah.
Like I might have been told it was his, but you never convinced me that he actually played it. Like it might have been at the house, but
I mean, I'm sure it could have easily been like a Christmas gift or something like that. Like, oh, you know, here's the shiny new toy. Everyone's talking about it. It's advertised everywhere. So you could see parents of that kind of previous generation of the NES thinking like, hey, I'm going to pick up this new toy, this new technology. Look at the video. This is the beginning of home console video games almost. So picking up an Atari that being inside a lot of houses that weren't gamers, you know, there were no gamers yet, right? So it kind of, it does make sense that you kind of saw those pop up every now and then. Like we had an Atari, we had an Intellivision. I don't know if we had a Coleco or anything, any of those other ones, but I remember, you know, my dad would pull those out when we were older, actually, like after the NES, he'd pull those out. And I get, you know, I guess he was nostalgic for Atari and Intellivision too, even though after you'd played the NES, it was very hard to go back to those games.
Yeah. Well, and on my mom's side, my aunt had a Commodore 64. Again, I don't recall them ever using the computer for anything.
No, no.
But I whenever I would go to my aunt's house, which was quite often because they were the closest relatives we had, I would just be going through floppy disks that were completely unlabeled and just...
Yeah, I love that.
Going through like, okay, pop this one in, hit the
what
list.
What is it? Any, is this any good? What, give it two yeah. minutes.
Yeah. What are on it? Oh, this game. I don't know what this game is. Let's just load it, see what happens.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, that was Commodore 64 and Atari was, I'm assuming that must be what got me into the Nintendo, because my only other memory of video games is going to this someone's house. I don't know who it is. Can't remember anything about the kid. Don't know why I was even allowed to go to this house. Because it's like in a part of town I've never gone again in the entirety of my life. So I have no idea why I was there. But I remember the kid had an NES and had Rad Racer. And that kind of hooked me. So yeah, after that it was video games for life.
That was not just video games. That was the beginning of your love affair with Square Enix too, right?
Yeah, exactly. My first NES game was a Square Enix game.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. As far as from an RPG as it can be, but still, yeah.
Well, let's not get too far into the episode before we are going to hawk your book. yeah, I'm sorry.
A little bit at least.
It's a necessity because I think everyone should buy it, so... Let's talk about what the book is and specifically, because we've kind of danced around it a bit.
Yeah, sure. So the title, the full title is A Game in the Life, A Personal Journey Through Timeless Video Games. And that subtitle kind of gives you the two kind of angles that the book is taking, or the two approaches, right? The personal journey, that's the kind of anecdotes, the memories from my life, you know, what was happening to me at these various stages, and what games was I playing at the time, basically, or how do the games I played in those moments kind of intersect with the growing up, the maturation, all the changes and the events that you're going through as you grow up, right? And then timeless video games, the other part, just games that I think are still very playable today that you can kind of pick up in 2023 and still have a ton of fun with, and maybe not perfect, but you know, there's a quality about them that gives them staying power, right? It's not like, you know, a Breath of the Wild that we might play 50 years from now and it still feels kind of perfect-ish, but these are games where there's an element where there's the gameplay, the aesthetic, the music, the kind of the way that they came about that makes them timeless. And so you have those kind of two things going on in every chapter. There's 17 chapters, and I try, you know, some of them are a little bit more heavy on breaking down what the games are, how they work, you know, trying to maybe explain them for people that might not be familiar with certain genres or video games much at all. But I do want the book to be accessible to everybody, right? I want, you know, whether you've played a game or you know people who play games, or maybe you play games, you know, constantly. Maybe you're a listener of the Thirsty Mage podcast. I want everybody to be able to kind of get into it and maybe see themselves in it or see someone they know in it and kind of either understand maybe their own past a little bit better or understand, you know, someone close to them. That's kind of my hope for the book. So there are 17 chapters in total, 17 different games. One of them is not a video game. I won't spoil that, but when you get into the book, you'll see what that is. You can buy it at, right now, you can buy it at Apple. So it's just an ebook right now. I am working on a physical version, kind of to be announced when that's going to be available, hopefully sooner rather than later. But that is in the works for those who prefer the physical versions. I do. So it's for me as much as anybody else. But it's on digitally, Apple, Barnes & Noble, Rakuten /Kobo. I think they're combined now, Smashwords, and then Amazon, other sites in addition to those, because it's available internationally as well. And then Amazon and Google Play Books are coming soon. The kind of process with those two and adding to their digital stores is just a little bit different. So it's going to be a little bit delayed. Hopefully, you know, within a week after launch is the November 16th. So available in a lot of places and more to come soon. Yeah.
I can tell you that the Rakuten Kobo is what I pre-ordered mine on.
Okay, good. Yeah. I keep bringing that one up. I think it's a good site for showing like the description of the book. It tells you like the number of pages, and it kind of shows like where the book is ranked. It has a nice kind of big picture of the cover as well. So I keep kind of going back to that one. It's just a template for myself.
Yeah, well, I have a. Well, my kids have Kobos.
They do. Okay.
Yeah. So I actually ended up reading it on my iPad, but I want it on the Kobo. So, cause I imagine my son will read it when it comes out.
Yeah.
Nice. And yeah, I just, the e-reader is kind of nice. Like the, on the eyes when you're staring at computer screen
for sure. And I haven't used e-readers very much. My wife has a Kindle, so Kindle obviously attached to Amazon, so when the book is available on Amazon, for those of you out there who do have a Kindle, you'll be able to get it on the Amazon store and view it on your Kindle. But Apple for iPads, Kobo for various e-readers, Barnes and Noble as well. You can get e-reader apps on your phones too, like Apple and I think in Google Pixel, Android, all the Android phones, I think they all have their own different apps that you can download to view ebooks. So even if you don't have a dedicated e-reader or a tablet you want to use, it's very easy to pick up the book on your phone through one of these sites, and then maybe their own app. I think Kobo has their own app. Barnes & Noble might have their own app as well. But there are a lot of avenues to pick up the digital version if you want to pick up that one earlier. Obviously, the digital version will be cheaper as well. It's listed, it's $4.99 US, $6.99 Canadian. So the physical version will be a little bit more expensive, obviously. So if you're looking to get the book a little bit cheaper, the ebook I think is a good way to do that.
Yeah, and if you go to thethirstymage.com, there's a link to the main page, which then kind of filters out to whatever one you end up going with. So if you're looking for the link, you can go there. Otherwise, you can also if you're on Twitter, you'll see it on Jordan's profile as well.
Yeah. I've been posting about it on social media the last couple of days. I'll obviously be posting on launch day as well. So you mentioned linking to it on the Thirsty Mage. So the nice thing that I've been able to share around, and this is something I'm learning about self-publishing, the website I'm using is called Draft2Digital. It's been really smooth process so far. So I'd recommend it to people that are looking to publish one of their own works, whether that's, you know, a short story, a collection, poetry, a novel, whatever. Draft2Digital does seem, so far at least, a pretty good resource for that. We'll see. Maybe they'll stiff me on the royalties or something like that. I'll have to do another podcast where I trash them, but it's been good so far. What they give you when the book is kind of ready to go, I guess, is they give you what's called a universal book link, or a UBL. And so that's what I've been kind of, that's what I gave David. That's what the Thirsty Mage page links to, is my UBL for A Game in the Life. And that UBL basically just shows all the stores where you can get the books. You can kind of choose your own store from that UBL. You get to see the cover. From there, I think you can access the author page as well, or at the very least, I've been sharing that around a lot as well. But yeah, clicking on any of the links give you a little bit of a description of the book. Obviously, if you're listening to this episode, you're kind of getting that anyways, but easy enough to share around the UBL, and give people a choice of where they want to pick up the book. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think the big question for me is, you know, we see daily all of these video game journalist sites, all this writing stuff just burning to the ground.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, What inspired you? Is it a revolution? Is it a rebellion against the trending ways that you just said, no, I'm writing. Screw all this video crap.
Yeah. It's funny. It's not really a reaction to anything that's happening kind of in society or in games media or journalism at large or anything like that. I think that ever since I started working on a BA in English, like I think I knew in the back of my mind, and maybe kind of that a thought kept growing, I'm going to write a book at some point. I feel like writing comes naturally to me. Like I don't find writing a taxing endeavor, like, you know, not to brag or something like that. It's just something that it's something I do that doesn't feel like a chore to me necessarily. Like I can sit down and get it done. Not to say I don't procrastinate. Goodness, no. I mean, I spent so many nights on campus at the University of British Columbia finishing English or even economics courses, papers, you know, at the last minute, right? They'd be due at midnight that night. I'd be writing them in the library at like 5 or 6 p.m. But I could do that. I could wait till the last minute and churn out a paper that was decent in 5 or 6 hours. You know, like I had that aptitude. And so it starts with this feeling like, okay, I want to write a book at some point, maybe multiple books, but we'll start here. And so how can I do that? What after you know you're going to write a book or have a desire to write a book, a goal to write one, you have to think about what's the content going to be. And so in doing my master's degree, this was another big part that kind of started it. I took a course as part of my master's. So at the University of Saskatchewan, you could do a project-based MA or a thesis-based one. And a thesis-based one, you basically are writing a book at that point. You're writing an academic paper, you know, let's say it's 100 pages or something like that. 100. We're talking about papers that you write for university or college, right? So not like 100 pages in a novel, but 100 pages of, 8.5 by 11, like a Word document or something like that. So that was quite an undertaking. I didn't want to do that. So I ended up doing an MA project stream at U of S. And one of the courses that I took as part of that project stream was a video game course, actually, where we did look at video games in the same way we would look at literature, right? Doing an MA in English, you know, a lot of the courses revolve around taking books, poems, drama, film, and analyzing them, right? Breaking them down. What do they mean? What's the author trying to say? What are these texts kind of tell us about society and humanity and all those things? But yeah, one of the courses ended up being about video games. And so what I did in that course is I wrote a bunch of papers about games. And for the project aspect of my master's, I had to take one of the papers I had written for one of my let's say I did 10 courses or so. I had to take one of my papers for one of those courses and extend it out into kind of like a miniature thesis. So this ended up being about 35 or 40 pages. And my project paper was about Mass Effect 2 and Dragon Age Origins. And, you know, of course I was going to choose RPGs to write about because I'd been playing RPGs my whole life. Right. And I guess it just so happened that maybe just before the Masters had started, I'd been playing games like that. I'd been playing, you know, Mass Effect or replaying them. Right. And I remember, you know, being in Saskatchewan, Saskatoon specifically, and then coming back home and, you know, because my mom worked for the airlines, I was able to fly back and forth pretty easily. And so I'd come home for like a weekend, you know, hang out with my girlfriend, who is now my wife. And I'd be playing, you know, these RPGs. I'd be playing these kind of Western style RPGs with, you know, their lots of decision making and dialogue trees and all that stuff. And so I was kind of playing them as if it were maybe preparation for something I wanted to write about more. And so I wrote a paper on those three games and about decision making and how the decision making that we do in RPGs like that, you know, non-linear style ones where you do have, you know, at least, you know, whether it's an illusion or not is beyond the scope of this podcast right now. But at the very least, you are making choices that seem to you to have an impact, right? And whether that impact is minimal or a little bit more realized, the point is you still are in a position to choose your own adventure, right? And that this idea of, you know, even starting as a kid, you know, doing choose your own adventure books, my grandparents would buy those for me all the time. I love them. To be able to do that in a video game format, it was just kind of paradise, right? Like I'm already playing games that I really love, but I'm also doing an activity I find very engaging in them. And so, yeah, so kind of spinning off of the project paper, I was like, okay, like at some point I might want to extend this out. And maybe that's a book down the road, but I'd already kind of been writing about games to an extent and wanted to do more of that. So then, you know, of course, 2018 comes around. I join Nintendo World Report. I'm writing reviews and dipping my toes into playing more games, thinking about them more critically, and trying to be objective about my thoughts about them and how they work, and just learning a little bit more about just video games in general as an art form, as a consumer product, as a thing that people kind of put their blood, sweat, and tears into. And eventually, it was just playing so many of these games and writing about so many of them, like, okay, I'm starting to kind of get a sense of what I want to write about. I want to write about how games from my past, I still remember today. I'm still reflecting on them as I'm reviewing games in the present, right? I'm reviewing Mega Man 11, for instance, but I'm thinking about Mega Man 2 and Mega Man 3. Why am I still thinking about those games, right? I'm playing Final Fantasy 15, but I'm longing for Final Fantasy 6, 4, 7. I'm thinking about those games. I'm playing, Breath of the Wild. I'm playing A Link Between Worlds. And I'm thinking, I love Link to the Past so much. And so these games end up making it into the book as ones that are timeless. If not for everybody, it's certainly for me, right? They are ones that personally, that there's a timeless quality that kind of sticks to me, or that sticks out to me, I suppose. Another thing was we have seen it a lot in the last 5 to 10 years, but these compilation kind of re-releases, right? The Ace Attorney games being kind of bundled up. The Mega Man Legacy Collection, a huge one for me. I ended up buying that in like 3 or 4 different places,
Pixel Remaster.
Pixel Remasters, of course, right? All these games kind of being brought to a modern audience. You're only doing that if you believe these games to have a timelessness to them, right? Like, you're not going to, if these games are trash, generally they don't come forward, although sometimes they do. And I feel like I've reviewed a bunch of those,
I was just thinking of what was that limited run just put out, the Plumbers Don't Wear Ties.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
I don't know if that one counts as timeless.
I certainly hope not. I mean, you know what? It's schlockiness. It's kind of like, it's awkwardness. There is something that will always stay, that'll always remain, right? It's shock value to an extent. It's still kind of there. But yeah, just seeing games from the past being brought forward more and more nowadays, right? That seems like a huge part of the industry, is remaking, remastering, reimagining. And so it just kind of stood to reason that my book would be something that looks back at those original releases and thinks about, okay, why are they so meaningful to me, and maybe to others as well. So speaking of like remakes, remasters, there's a chapter on Metroid Zero Mission, right? Metroid Zero Mission is a remake, right? But it's such a different game that it almost, it goes beyond that. It goes beyond, it kind of redefines what a remake is. And I argue that in that chapter, that, this is like the quintessential remake of a game, with that emphasis on re for certain. Like, it is Metroid, sure, but it's also entirely its own thing. So, yeah, but lots of different inspirations, and it was kind of a progression, but it basically started about 3 years ago, where I kind of started putting pen to paper and kind of putting the chapters down, and really kind of started with the Timeless Game series that I did at NWR, and the videos that I made, and the Final Fantasy VI one was on the Thirsty Mage. The timelessness of these games, like I was kind of experimenting with my ideas in those kind of short articles and videos. And for the book, I kind of revamped those thoughts, extended them all out, added kind of more to the elements of my life that were going on at those times. And that's kind of where the memoir or autobiography aspect, I guess, came in.
Yeah. Well, that was it was funny because there was a lot of games, there's a lot of overlap between the games that you and I grew up with. So I was reading Final Fantasy VI and Mega Man 2, like a lot of these games. There's a few that I either haven't played or just didn't get into, but it was just fun to see like the kind of juxtaposition of like, oh, that's when you played that game, and then this is what was happening to you at the time, sort of thing. So to see that was pretty funny. Don't want to get into too many, but I did have a good chuckle about the evil deeds that you did to a couple of friends.
Yes, I'm not perfect. I made mistakes. Those had to come out in some form. They did. They were related to video games.
The one thing that did stand out to me, and it's funny because in the notes, the question I had for you is front and center, is that there are some games. The book can't go on forever. You had to choose,
of course. Yeah,
yeah.
Narrow it down.
But I could not believe that Chrono Trigger was not inside the book somewhere.
Yeah.
I thought it was like a hidden chapter that I had to unlock. Like, I don't know why it was in there. You have to explain to me how this hit the cutting room floor.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think I have a great answer. I think the fact is Chrono Trigger is kind of, maybe since its release, been less in the limelight than Final Fantasy VI. The fact that Final Fantasy VI, it was kind of, I'm not choosing between those two, but for a lot of reasons, I just leaned more towards Final Fantasy VI, and that felt more natural to include in the book than Chrono Trigger. And don't get me wrong, I love Chrono Trigger. It's one of my favorite games of all time, for sure. I literally have like artwork on my kid's wall behind me, and not that they're in the same room. In their bedroom, I put up like an art piece, and I got it framed of like the beginning of the game where, you know, the mom, Chrono's mom, is like at the window, kind of opening the blinds. He's waking up. The cat's there. That game resonates so much with me. But the fact that that game has kind of been not forgotten, but abandoned to an extent, you know, we haven't kind of seen those re-releases. We haven't seen, there aren't a lot of people that kind of talk about Chrono Trigger all the time or didn't kind of become its own series. You know, Chrono Cross came back recently, and it's surprising that Trigger hasn't still. But you think about Final Fantasy VI, like Final Fantasy VI is constantly alluded to, talked about, because you have all these future entries in the series and those being remade and those being re-released. And then you have the pixel remasters. There's just so many, something about FF6 that I find a lot more accessible than Chrono Trigger. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk more about FF6 than Chrono Trigger. I just feel like that game just has a more kind of more public presence than Chrono Trigger does. And I imagine, you know, I'm probably dating myself, you know, maybe in a year from now, we will have a Chrono Trigger, you know, remake in the style of like Star Ocean 2 that just came out, you know, something like that. I'm sure there are people working on what that kind of bringing that game forward is going to be, but that doesn't exist yet. So for those kind of reasons, I decided to leave it out. There's also the idea that I thought I had a better story, a better kind of set of memories to go with Final Fantasy VI than Chrono Trigger. And that was maybe the kind of tipping point for me, was that, yeah, okay, it's close between those two, both, you know, major impact on me. And in terms of, you know, the games that I like to play, the games that I remember still, that I still think about. But Chrono Trigger, I don't have, those were, playing that game was more of an independent thing for me, right? I remember having a player's guide, which I really loved. I remember a friend of mine kind of borrowing the player's guide and kind of doing his own artwork based on the characters in the guidebook. But I don't have a lot of shared memories of that game. And it was Final Fantasy VI that I had more, not trauma, but I had kind of more poignant memories associated with. And so that to me, that's why the game stuck out more in my memory, is that there's just events in my life connected to FF6 more so than Chrono Trigger. So it's not, again, the timeless games in A Game in the Life aren't just the ones that are the best games. They are the ones that have a major impact on me, right? So yeah, you know, maybe there's a part two where I talk about Chrono Trigger and I remember some story that came up with it, but yeah, it just didn't, it wasn't connected with a moment or a series of moments growing up for me as much. And again, I probably put Chrono Trigger ahead of Final Fantasy VI for the record, but yeah, just a different thing going on in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, it actually made me think of like some of the games in my own life, like where it's like, you know, those points of, you know, life changing or, and I was thinking of like those games, even though they were there at these very important times in my life, I don't necessarily go back to them anymore.
No, sure, sure.
I was thinking of like GoldenEye on 007. Like that was the first, like the Nintendo 64 is the first console I paid with my own money. GoldenEye, I spent like hours and hours and hours playing multiplayer with my brother. It's kind of like one of the things that we bonded, like, because there's seven years between us, so mm-hmm. I think I was like 16 and he was 9 at the time, so
yeah,
you know, there's not a whole lot of things you can bond over when you're that in such that different kind of parts of your life, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But he was good enough video game player that it was, you know, he could keep up with me, so the you know, blowing each other up with proximity mines was a great part of the day.
Oh, and then the happiest of memories was someone running into a proximity mine that you carefully planted, or better, seeing one on the wall and using like a pistol to aim and shoot it out, right? That you knew was a trap. Like that, that's almost as satisfying.
I always love hiding in the bathroom of the
bunker,
and then you opening the door and trying to toss the proximity mines into the bathroom to try to trigger them, and then you knew they were stuck, or if they were stupid enough to go up into the ventilation, then they're really screwed because you just toss it up there and run out.
That was the worst place to get. Yeah, you think you're being clever, but you're not. If I'm remembering correctly, you could jump on the toilet to kind of like, you couldn't see your legs underneath, right? So you could get a little bit more height. But I think if you were playing as Odd Job, you could stand on the toilet and no one could see the top of your head. And they couldn't see your feet. So they literally had no idea if you're in there, right? So another kind of cheat activated.
We had to ban Odd Job from our multiplayer. We all did, because the smaller target
too easy to dodge the bullets.
And then the other one for me was Knights of the Old Republic, because
that's a good one.
It was the first game, or the main game I played when I moved out of the house for the first time in my life. So I moved to Ottawa, and the move was not smooth. I'll just say that it was it was a pretty rocky time. So I would just dump hours and hours and hours into Knights of the Old Republic on my laptop.
Yeah.
When I should have been doing homework, because I was in third year university at that point. But I was I need to get through this game, and probably played it three or four times.
You're specializing in Star Wars RPGs at that point. So, this is my hope with a game in the life, is not for people to read and be like, I don't really care about this guy's life. Like, why is he telling me all these stories and talking about these games? I want other people to kind of remember their own times with these games, or different ones, right? Like what you're doing right now, reminiscing about GoldenEye and KOTOR, right? Like that's my hope, is that people will pick up this game, this book, and think about their own, games in their life, that this book had kind of happened to them as well, but they didn't really, it wasn't really top of mind, or they've moved on to an extent and they have different hobbies now, but maybe at some point they had games in their life that resonated with whatever was happening to them at the time. Obviously other games I could have definitely talked about, Mass Effect and Dragon Age. I do talk about Mass Effect 2 in the book, but I had to omit those other games, which are incredibly important to me, and I still, I revisited obviously the Mass Effect trilogy with the Legendary Edition that came out a couple years ago. Dragon Age, we're still kind of waiting to see what happens with those old games. I'm surprised they haven't been brought forward. It does sound like we have new entries coming in both series. I'm really excited about that, but I can only talk about one of those BioWare games. League of Legends was a big one for me, a big omission, because there was, it felt like 3 to 4 years of my life where I was playing mostly League of Legends, and it might still be the game that I have the most hours played, if you can believe that. Just kind of based on the style of the game, the fact that, if you do get really into it and you're playing every day, that's 40-minute matches, you've played two or three, it's 2 to 3 hours a day, every day. It's almost like a part-time job. But League of Legends, just a quick anecdote about it. We made our own league of this game. So League of Legends is a MOBA, multiplayer online battle arena. It's basically a 5v5 game where you're trying to destroy the other person's tower or castle, fortress at their base, and they're trying to do the same thing to you. We made our own league where we drafted people onto teams. Like, we held a draft, we held a trophy presentation, we had, monetary prizes. At some point, Riot Games, the makers of League of Legends, actually sponsored our league and gave us kind of current in-game currency to give away as part of a prize. And so League of Legends was a massive one for me, and just in terms of the friends that I made playing that game, and just kind of the wherewithal to have our own league and to organize all these things, and to just be super invested in a game for such a long time. I am not surprised, but I do wish that I could find a way to get League of Legends in the book, and maybe a different a new version down the line, perhaps. But that League of Legends was a big one for me. I don't play the game at all now, and that's why maybe to me it's not super timeless. It was something I definitely had to quit and just move on from. But for a time, it was a major thing for me. And then one more guess, prominent omission. Diablo 2, like, still playing Diablo 4 now, you know, we've been kind of, Diablo 4 is a game that I feel like I'm going to be going back to periodically with the seasonal play. But Diablo 2, I played that game, you know, when it came out, when the expansion came out. I read that strategy guidebook back to front multiple times, you know, just kind of theory crafting characters and builds and stuff like that. I played every single character type probably multiple times, hardcore characters, multiplayer, single player, you name it. I did kind of everything with Diablo 2. Like I was at the age when that game came out where I had more free time, or I was making more free time. And, you know, I was playing with my brother and playing with his friends and everybody else. And Diablo 2 is a major one. Just, again, a lot of hours sunk into it, and even revisited it a few months ago or like a year ago, as part of a kind of a bachelor party type thing. So, yeah,
did you pick up Resurrected?
I didn't. No, I didn't. I didn't pick up the re-release of it.
Okay.
I think just too many other games at the time that I didn't feel like I had the time to go back. But also, like, the crew that I played with before, I didn't know that they were getting into it either, and for that reason, kind of lost some luster.
Yeah.
But you know, again, there's lots of other games I could talk about. Those are some of the more noteworthy omissions, I guess, and ones that I would love to talk about in the future for sure. But I'm happy with the number of games that are in there. I think it's the right amount for the kind of the stories that I had to tell at this time. And yeah, I just can't wait for people to get into it.
Hmm. Well, and it's like you said, for kind of thought provoking. Like, for me, the other thing I thought about was, like, you know, I've had this, you know, 40 years of playing. Well, I guess I haven't been playing video games for 40 years, but the 35 years, I guess, around there of playing video games, and then thinking, like, okay, like, I had all these experiences and these moments, but, you know, what are my kids gonna grow up remembering? And I know, and your kids are getting to the age of, like, they're playing video games.
My oldest, especially. My youngest, a little bit, he's starting into Smash Bros a tiny bit. My oldest is well on his way to being into it.
I was even just curious about kids in general. Like, I'll talk about, I already know a couple games that I'm sure my kids will have a fondness for one day and remember, but just in general, it's just such a different environment from back then. Like, you know, I talk about the overlap that you and I have, but at the same time, it's like there's gonna have to be overlap, because back then there was either the NES or the Genesis, mm-hmm. or the Master. I don't even remember anyone having a Master System.
I knew one person that had it. We played, like, Altered Beast maybe once or twice, maybe Sonic. I don't even remember that, but it was kind of forgettable.
I don't know if I ever saw anyone with a Master System. I've seen one person in my life with the Genesis. Everyone else had Nintendo. So there was.
I knew a few more with the Genesis, but they also had a Nintendo as well. Like, so we would maybe alternate a little bit, but I never played a lot of Sega consoles growing up.
And it really wasn't until PlayStation came that the game library really started expanding. Like, having so much choice, and PC, I guess, too,
PC for
really
sure.
Expanding.
A lot, more genres, right? Like, you know, the shooter genre kind of taking off with stuff like Doom. You know, obviously, computer role playing games, you know, probably predated, you know, anything on a console, but it was those games that kind of inspired all the RPGs that we ended up coming to love, right? Like Final Fantasy and stuff.
Yeah, so we might have grown up with, like, hundreds of options of games, but our kids are growing up with millions of options of games.
Yeah, it does feel that way.
So it's I really going to be curious about, you know, 10, 20 years from now, what kind of nostalgia will be for the games of old. The first game I'm going to bring up, because it's my son's, I would say it's the first video game that he got into, but it's also the one he's been playing the longest, mm-hmm. and that's Fortnite.
Yeah.
And it's funny, because as we're recording this, Fortnite, the latest season of Fortnite is Fortnite OG.
Yeah, but we're already there, right? We're already.
Believe it. Yeah. It makes me so sad.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, so for, like, with me, so my kid's almost a teenager now, and we've been playing Fortnite since the beginning. Like, he actually, it's funny, because we're playing OG, but he remembers all the places, like the guns. Yeah. He remembers the guns, the places. And someone who's not quite a teenager yet has nostalgia for a game is weird,
mm-hmm.
but we're, you know, it, for me, it's actually going to Fortnite will actually be a timeless game for me. Well, kind of is already just because it's the game that my son and I are like, we play together after school. Yeah. Like even now, like we come home, we'll play a little bit after school. So that'll always stick with me for that reason specifically.
Like I love that. I love that. Like you kind of thinking of it as timeless, maybe your son thinking of it as timeless. That's so fantastic. And as ridiculous as it is that there's a Fortnite OG, I think it's incredibly popular. I think a lot of people have been playing it and talking about it, right?
We couldn't even get on when it first, we had to wait like 10 minutes just to get onto the server, which has been years since that's ever been an issue.
I mean, I the only other one I can think of doing, like World of Warcraft obviously did that, you know, with their kind of going back to basics and kind of re-releasing the original game and stuff like that. To I think, a fair bit of success. And to see Fortnite do it makes sense. Like, we're going to, I don't think this is the end of that trend. We're going to see games kind of go back to their 1.0, maybe not Final Fantasy 14, you know, or something like that. That is probably going to leave that in the past. But gosh, who knows? Like, all these kind of games with a major online component kind of going back to the past as a way of kind of creating nostalgia for their game. It's really interesting to see.
Yeah. Well, the scary thing with Fortnite, though, is like one day people are going to stop playing it to the point where it gets shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And then you won't be able to play it again. Like, it's not like you can be like, oh, I have the physical copy. It's like, well, no, the servers will be gone one day. It'll be just gone.
Yeah.
So, again, kind of a weird time in gaming, because even now, you know, I still got I can still pop my NES. My Final Fantasy NES battery still works. Like,
love that.
So I could still play that, but one day, the kids won't be able to play Fortnite, which,
I mean, this,
you know,
is
good or bad.
This is the tricky. I mean, there'll be a Fortnite 2 or something. Don't worry, there'll be something else just to take its place. But I mean, this is the tricky thing. And again, another kind of impetus or reasoning behind wanting to write this book is that there is a fleetingness to the games that are released around now. You think about like mobile games, the fact that, you know, hundreds, thousands of Flash games are now gone. You know, they don't exist anymore. But mobile games getting shut down, you know, games you play more on an iPad or something like that, those kind of getting shut down, going away. Just games that are only digital, right? And that's going to be more and more games going forward, or kind of online dependent, that they have a shelf life, right? That these games will not last forever. It does make me sad in a way, you know, that it's very difficult to preserve those things. And so you just kind of have to be in the moment playing those games, enjoying them and keeping your memories of them. And that's why I kind of wanted to share my memories of old games too. Like maybe one day you won't be able to play Mega Man 2 or Kirby's Adventure or something like that. Like I want people to be able to read about those games and kind of see, okay, how did they work? I know this character, Mega Man, I know who Kirby is, I know who Mario is, but I've never played this game with that character. So I want to know kind of, where did it start? You know, how was it at the beginning? How was it 20, 30, 40 years ago? I'm hoping to preserve a little bit of that. Like I really appreciate the endeavor of preserving things, preserving video games, that the written word or the books in general have a power of preservation about them. I'm trying to participate in that a little bit for sure.
Yeah. The game I miss the most that I can't play anymore is it was on PC. It was a WWE, like a trading card game.
Okay.
And the way it worked was that, like, there was, I think there was like 10 or 12 wrestlers. So like you would basically pick the wrestler that you wanted. They'd have their own like health and there was like things where like you had heavyweights and agility. And so they had all these different features to them. And then, there was moves that were common for everyone, and then there was like trademark moves, and you would have to buy it was like it so much reminds me of playing the Pokemon game now, where it's almost very similar, where it's like you have to pick out like energy, like agility, energy, or I'm saying that I'm like, I don't know if there was energy in that game, because there was like this momentum system that built in where you could only do certain moves if you had so much momentum going forward.
Right,
and then there was like counters and stuff. But it was all linked to like a server. And then the server just like, they turned it off one day. And luckily at the time, like this was years ago, so I can't imagine it's still active, but there was a community, like they saved the game, like they created their own server so that people could still play it. And then they unlocked all of the cards.
That's awesome.
I probably spent you know, hundreds of dollars on these freaking cards. And then all of a sudden one day, like every single one of them was available, all free, but which is fine. Cause it really let me like let loose into the game.
Yeah.
But I miss it so much.
It's funny because what you're mentioning is the same thing that happened with World of Warcraft, right? I believe there was a community that kind of was already keeping the original World of Warcraft alive on like private servers or something like that. So Blizzard was smart enough to realize, oh, hey, if people like are making this effort to keep the old versions of the game alive, let's just free release it, right? put a fresh coat of paint on it or whatever. People will pay for this. And they did. I think in droves they did. And so now they're kind of going through, all the old expansions and kind of redoing them and stuff like that, too. Casey's the person we should be asking or talking. He should be speaking to that. But yeah. At any rate, there is people, like you say, making that effort to preserve something or to open it up after it's gone. Totally respect that, but it does suck that some of these games are just gone, you know, never to be seen by new people that never came across them, I guess.
Yeah, and imagine another big game for kids will be Minecraft, because
I can't believe I didn't write that down. Like, you added that to the notes. I'm like, yeah, that's the biggest one.
Yeah, I can't believe how big it is even now. My daughter has a friend down the street. She doesn't play any video games except Minecraft.
Yeah, I think that's true of a lot of kids, kind of your daughter's age and around that age. You know, anyone from like 6 to 15, I think, could be that. Like, I only play Minecraft or I only play Roblox. Right? It's just those two, you know.
Yeah.
I added a couple games I think people might look back at. Rocket League, I think, will be a big one. I think the fact, you know, they were really smart with Rocket League too. When it first came out for free on PlayStation, I guess if you were a PlayStation Plus kind of member and you got the game for free, I think that was a smart way to kind of propel it. Rocket League has online esports presence. It's on multiple platforms now as well. I think there is still a decent online community for the game, and I think it does still get somewhat regular updates, maybe for cosmetics and stuff like that. But Rocket League, I think, was a big one. I think there was a time when everyone I know was playing Rocket League, and I do still kind of revisit it from time to time as well. Another one, I'm not 100% sure about this, but the reason I mentioned is because a lot of athletes play these games. But 2K, so 2K Sports, specifically like NBA 2K, at least I come across that a little bit more. Being someone who plays basketball, like you hear about all these like basketball players in the NBA playing 2K, right? Whether that's playing NBA 2K or one of the other sports games, one of their other sport franchises, I guess. But I feel like that could be one people look back on, and it's because it's not a singular entry, right? Every year there's a new one, but just the fact that people played 2K for a time, and maybe, you know, one day there will be no more 2K games, and sports games will look something very different. Look like something completely different. I don't know.
Well, FIFA's gone now, right? There's no...
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, no FIFA license currently.
It's like FC or EAFC or something like that with a member.
You're tired of paying the FIFA license, I guess.
I mean, I think I get it. I kind of get it why. I think they were trying to charge him an arm and a leg for that. Not that EA doesn't have the money, but I feel like people were going to buy the game, whether it was called, you know, soccer or FIFA or FC or whatever. Yeah. It didn't matter as long as the gameplay was the same kind of thing.
They just use country names. Who cares?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And then the last one, I'm curious what you think about this edition. I think it's possible that people a game in the life 20 years hence could include something like Breath of the Wild. And I think that kids who played Breath of the Wild, you know, in their teens, in their, 8, 9, 10 kind of adolescent period, I wonder if Breath of the Wild will be one that they see as being timeless and they think back on it so fondly. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. Like, my brother's daughter will be that way. Like, she's probably put a couple hundred hours into Breath of the Wild, and it's her favorite game. My kids didn't take to it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I don't know if... I think partially it was maybe just before their time. So they weren't that interested in it. I know my son's played it a bit, but it's...
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe just a little too... Like, it's funny to say slow, but it's like there's not much... Like, there's the exploration part, but it's just kind of a slow pace to it, I would say. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like... action all the time or anything, right?
No, you do kind of have to get yourself feeling like lost in it, you know. And I wonder, you know, we're going to talk about Tears of the Kingdom when we get down to our game of the year podcast episodes, but there's something about Breath of the Wild that I remember a little bit more, or intrigues me a little bit more than Tears. That there's a simplicity to it. There's not a lack of content, but there are just empty spaces. And I think that it's something that actually works for Breath of the Wild. Will not work for everyone who plays it, but I think it's something just in general, kind of, again, trying to think of it objectively, I think it works for that game. Whereas Tears of the Kingdom there's so much to it. It's almost overwhelming. Breath of the Wild, a little bit less so, and maybe just the right amount, at least for me. But yeah, I could see Breath of the Wild being one of those games that, like, you know, we look back at Final Fantasy 1, Mega Man 2, Super Mario Brothers 3, and I think Breath of the Wild is probably going to be in that. Just given how popular the Switch has been with people, and how Breath of the Wild was kind of the beginning of the Switch, right? If Breath of the Wild wasn't there on day one, you could argue the Switch wouldn't be as popular today as it is, you know, that it was one of those games you just kicked off the Switch kind of mania. There's just this new, this reimagined Zelda game with this massive world that's perfect for playing on the TV or in bed, right? Which a lot of people did. A lot of people kind of played it in both configurations. And that game just worked out really well for it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny too, because there seemed to be a debate online today about Breath of the Wild versus Tears of the Kingdom.
Right.
I saw a lot of people saying that Breath of the Wild was the better game. So
yeah, I think, and we're going to get into that in a massive way soon, but I do kind of lean in that direction as well.
Yeah. Well, I have the perfect way to end the podcast.
Let's do it. Let's hear it.
All right. So as of this recording, my pre-order of your book just went live.
I didn't know where you're going with that, but I literally, as you said that, I just got a text from a buddy saying the exact same thing. So yeah. Kudos to you and he for the heads up. That's really awesome. Yeah. Here we are. Perfect time to record, I guess, for us.
Yeah. So for everyone out there, it's no longer a pre-order.
That's right.
It's available for purchase.
Awesome. It's really cool to just be able to say that. And I've told so many people about it, you know, colleagues at work, friends, family, everyone's been super supportive. David, obviously you've been super supportive about it too. And you know, kind of facilitating this episode, making this happen, kind of planning for it. So that was great. Really appreciate that. I guess I need to get into the plugs here. Obviously, you know, now that the book is available, if you do want to hit up that Universal Book link I mentioned earlier, obviously it's going to be linked in a bunch of places, whether that's on my social media, on thethirstymage.com, Nintendo World Report. We're going to have a news article going up in the morning with a link to it as well. But if you're good at remembering things, I try to create a link that's a little bit easier to remember. So it's books2read.com, books2read, that number two, books with an S, books2read.com/agameinthelife. books2read.com/agameinthelife. So,
and the A Game in the Life is all one word.
All one word. Yeah. No spaces, no dashes, nothing like that. Yeah. books2read.com/agameinthelife. You get the nice thing about the site that I was publishing through, they give you an option to adjust the Universal Book link if you want to kind of create a custom one. So you just I just added the book title in at the end after the slash and thought that'd be at least a little bit easier to remember to tell people about if I don't have a way to just give them the link digitally or something like that. So yeah, I want to say like it's a relief that the book is out, but it's not, because now like the I have to keep pumping the tires on yeah. It, you know, and keep kind of telling people about it and getting people to, you know, share reviews and share impressions and stuff like that. So it's a new process that's happening. I think I mentioned earlier that a physical copy is coming soon. Hopefully within the next 2 or 3 weeks. I'm aiming for a December launch for that one, because I'd spoken to a lot of people. They're like, oh, we really want a physical copy. I'm like, yeah, I want to do that too. But yeah, there's a lot of interest in that. So that is coming down the line. Just don't know when. If you're able to pick up the ebook early, that's fantastic. Really appreciate the support from everybody. And yeah, I guess here we are, day one. Let's go.
Yeah. Well, I've read it. Wholeheartedly recommend it to everyone listening to pick it up. I think it'll be a good read, and it's fun. It just happens to be the holiday season too. So, I mean, what perfect gift? There you go. $10.
There you go. So if there's someone in your life, you know, they're into books or they're into video games and maybe you want to get, I mean, there aren't a ton of books about video games. Like just kind of thinking about it. Like I've read a bunch of them, you know, Blood, Sweat and Pixels, like Jason Schreier, like obviously, you know, love his work, love those two novels, but I wanted to do something kind of in that sphere as well. And it's a very different style. Obviously that's more kind of research-based, the anecdotes of other people. This is a very personal story, you know, a personal book that I've written here. So I do hope it'll resonate with people. I hope that people will kind of have the same kind of memories that we brought up on this episode, you know, that thinking about how the things that happened in someone else's life, like, you know, my experiences aren't, you know, mine alone. Like we were all in school once upon a time, you know, we've had relationships, you know, we've had friendships, we've had, you know, though we've had both of those end as well. You know, we've had, you know, our hearts broken, we've had, you know, jobs, you know, not work out. Like these are all kind of things that those themes come up in the book constantly. So it is a book about shared experiences as well. And so I do hope that people will latch onto those and kind of be able to kind of reminisce and feel nostalgic for a little while. That's my goal with the book. I just do hope that comes to fruition.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I want to congratulate you and hoping I know it'll do good, and I'm rooting for you.
Thank you, David. Appreciate you. Appreciate everybody listening as well. Thanks for joining us on this episode. Hope you'll pick up. Hope you pick up the book, whether that's an ebook version starting today or on the 16th, and then maybe a physical version down the line. A couple of people asked me to record an audiobook, and I'm like, I'm going to kill myself trying to get all these versions out. So audiobook way down the line, maybe in 2024, we'll see. You know, all this podcast work, this video voiceover, definitely getting me ready to do an audiobook version, but
we're waiting for Kelsey Grammer to be, his schedule to open up.
Wouldn't that be ridiculous? I'm going to pay, you know, I'm going to charge you for like 20 or 30 cameos, you know, like it's going to cost me an arm and a leg, but we'll do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, thanks everybody for listening. I hope you'll check out the book, you know, recommend it to friends and family who might be interested. Pick it up if you can. If you can leave a review where you pick it up, or it's also on goodreads.com. So if you want to go to Goodreads and leave a rating there or leave a review, that'd be fantastic. But yeah, thanks everybody for listening. Pick up A Game in the Life. You know, check out the UBL that is on my social media or on the thirstymage.com. Be talking about it more in the coming days. But yeah, we'll be back next week with another episode of The Thirsty Mage. Probably not covering a book, but definitely covering some of our favorite RPGs. Bye for now.
Bye.